If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Hi there. I would love it if you would give Other People's Pockets a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening on. If you're only listening to the audio and you're curious to see the video, find me on YouTube at It's Maya Money. You can also follow me on Instagram or TikTok at It's Maya Money. And all of my socials, including LinkedIn, can be found by looking at my website, mayalau.com. And as always, please feel free to email me at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com.
Have seen people do surrogacy, get a bunch of money, spend it, and then regret it. Be like, I bought new furniture and I bought a new car and now I don't have that money anymore and I don't even
it's
like this furniture
grow.
And
yeah.
My car is worthless. So it's like,
yeah.
Now I have to do another journey and then I'm going to make different choices with the money next time. It'd be nice if they had that foresight earlier.
My guest today is Sunshine Hansen. She's a 3-time gestational surrogate, which means that on 3 different occasions, she was pregnant with and gave birth to other people's babies and was compensated for it. Her experience of helping families who wanted biological children but couldn't carry them on their own and navigating the financial realities of that inspired her to start her own agency, Surrogacy Is, which matches intended parents with prospective surrogates. I've always wanted to interview a surrogate because I'm fascinated by the idea of getting paid to do something that's so personal and that you ultimately can't put a price on. We talked about how much money she made by being a surrogate, how it helped her pay off debt and reach some financial goals she had, the ethics of paying someone to be pregnant, and how different countries guard against exploitation. We also talked about the kind of financial literacy that should be talked about more in life and also in the world of surrogacy. I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets, the show where I ask people how much money they make and how their finances work so that the questions we all have about money can be a little bit less of a mystery. And now, here's my interview with Sunshine Hansen. Sunshine Hansen, thank you so much for being on Other People's Pockets.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Where am I reaching you today?
I am just outside of Savannah, Georgia.
And what room is that? I love your decor.
This is my podcast room. It's actually a little hovel, and it's like a little pocket office in the front of my home. And it's a total mess, except for the background.
No, it looks amazing. I love that you have a whole podcast room in your house.
Yeah, me too. This is one of those rooms that when we built this house, we were like, nobody would have any clue what to do with this little room. And I knew right away, I was like, oh, yes, this is perfect. That's where I'll do my podcast.
Did you build it or did you buy it like that and it was a bonus room?
We built it. So we got to pick the floor plan and it really works for us because my husband and I both work from home and we have 4 dogs. So our whole house is designed around like managing the chaos of the dogs and the business. So,
well, I'm sure we're going to talk about that more, because I imagine that surrogacy is the path to where you got to build your own house. I've always wanted to talk to a surrogate because it's this mixture of the practical with the personal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's where money meets just very real life things like your body, health, both your family and another family. And so I want to just hear about your journey and how you wound up becoming a surrogate.
When I had my son, I was only 16. So I was a teen mom, and I did everything that I'm very proud of myself. I was a teen mom. I finished high school. I went to college. I got my teaching credential. I became an English teacher. I worked really hard to have like a really practical, safe financial and career path. Like, I've always been very mindful about, like, I just want to do the safe, right thing, since I set my life into chaos at such a young age. So when I was about 32, I think my son was 16. My husband and I were both working really hard. He had started his own computer repair company, and he was working really hard, but investing a lot and not making a lot of money, but spending a lot of time. And I was teaching, which also was working a lot, investing a lot of time and not making a ton of money. So I was always trying to figure out, like, how do we get ahead? How do we get to the place where I want to buy a home? I don't want to rent forever. I want to be able to buy my son a car. He's learning how to drive. We're going to have to start thinking about college. Like, where is this extra money going to come from? We're making it, we're getting by, but how am I going to do these big things that are coming up in life that I'm just like feel insurmountable? And I had a acquaintance who had been a surrogate, and I watched her journey and when she first carried, and it had been years since then. And I was like, that's really weird and interesting. Like, but really, I thought she's just like one of those people that is really kind and giving and wants to do something. She was really passionate LGBTQ advocate. And so she wanted to carry for a gay couple. And I thought that's really neat, like for other people, not for me, because I'm so practical and safe. And surrogacy is not that. It's not practical. It's not like what you think, oh, this is an easy path to get some extra income. But then I watched her do it again, and I watched her buy her home, and I watched, like, I was like, okay, maybe there's something to this. I think if I want to get ahead, I can be pregnant. I don't want to have any more kids. I actually didn't love being pregnant. I kind of hated being pregnant, but it wasn't bad. It was fine. I didn't have any complications or anything. So I thought, okay, I can do this again. But my husband had never seen me pregnant, and he thought it was crazy. So he was like the first hurdle that I had to overcome. Cause like once I got it in my head, I was like thinking about the compensation for surrogacy and how I could use that to advance my goals. And I didn't want to take no for an answer from my husband or from mm-hmm. all my family who thought
it
was crazy.
You weren't with him at the time that you had your son.
No, so we got together when later. He was six. So he had never even seen me pregnant before. Right. He was like, this is just sounds like something that's going to derail our lives. Like, you're going to get pregnant and you're going to give away this baby, and then you're going to be really sad, and then our lives are going to be ruined. And like that was his big fear. So I had to spend a lot of time learning more, and so that I could educate him. So he finally was reluctantly on board. A lot of people come to surrogacy for lots of different reasons. They know somebody who struggled with infertility. They have different reasons. Mine was very much financially motivated, was my reason for going to surrogacy, because I had goals that I couldn't find another way to meet, because I wasn't going to take on another job. I was already working like 55 hours a week teaching with lesson planning and prep and grading.
So how much money did you make with that first surrogacy?
My first journey was in 2015, and my base compensation was $28,000, which is not today a lot of money. It wasn't a ton of money back then either. Like, I had to plan, how am I going to use this and maximize this? I also carried twins, so there's a little bit additional compensation for that. It was an additional $10,000, so my compensation then was $38,000. And it's not It's not that much, honestly.
Do you think that you could have at that time negotiated for a bit more? Or do you think that was just sort of the range of what was available to you?
At the time that I signed up to do it, the only knowledge there was not a lot of information. There was not Kim Kardashian hadn't done surrogacy yet. Like, it wasn't in the mainstream. And so I just kind of had to go on the guidance of the agency that my acquaintance had used, and she referred me to, and I went with them because I knew she used them and she had a good experience. And they said, here's your compensation sheet. Like, this is what you get for surrogacy. It wasn't presented to me as being negotiable in any way. But now it definitely is.
And did the story and the situation of the intended parents weigh into your decision making? Like, would you have said no if it was for somebody that you just didn't feel called to carry a
absolutely
child for?
Absolutely. So when I first decided to do it, I didn't have any envision of who it was going to be. But I just had to go through the process of doing my background check and my psych evaluation and my medical records and all the screening and labs and things that go into it. And then once you're fully screened is when you get to start looking at profiles of intended parents. And that's when it got really exciting. And I started to realize like the gravity of what I was actually signing up to do and read the stories of the parents. And it's like, you really don't realize how many people seem to struggle and have this brutal journey. But the profile that spoke to me, I think I looked about 5 profiles and turned them down before I found the one that I wanted, was a gay couple in Australia that they were about my husband and I same age. Gab was in IT and my husband was in IT, and they had this picture in their profile of them with their little dogs in like Christmas sweaters. And my husband and I are obsessed with our dogs. So I felt really drawn to them. And I was really excited to meet them when I saw their profile. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, like, these are the guys. These are the ones I want to help.
Do you have a lot of power as the surrogate to say, I get to choose? I mean, obviously they have to say yes to you too, but you kind of have some power, it sounds like, in deciding who you want to be a surrogate for.
You definitely do. You should. I think there are a lot of agencies out there, like now that I've been working in the industry for the last 9 years, there are a lot of agencies that don't match that way. So I'm really grateful that I was with an agency that had that an intentional matching and the autonomy for me, even if it wasn't in the form of how I set my compensation, but it was at least in letting me choose who I wanted to help. There are agencies that will say, okay, you're a surrogate, we've matched you. And you're like, oh, okay, who have you matched me with? And then sometimes they're like, oh, you don't really need to meet them and you'll just go through this pregnancy. And some people who, you know, don't know any better naively go through that process that way. And I don't think that that would feel good or worth it to me, especially because at the end of the journey, when I realized, like, you know, you think I'm going to get pregnant, I'm going to have a baby, I'm going to recover, and then I'm going to have this money, and then I'm going to go on with my life. But you don't realize how disruptive the whole process is going to be to your life. And so if I hadn't had that connection and like really loved my intended parents and didn't get to see like FaceTime with their moms after the babies were born and see them crying and being so grateful, and like if I didn't have that joy and that pride, that euphoric feeling that I had at the end, and I just had $28,000, I would have felt really bad. It wouldn't be worth it. It's not worth it. It's not worth it for the money. It's got to be both. Even if it was $150,000, if you don't have that sense of, like, I did a really good thing for some really good people, I don't think it would feel worth it.
Right. And it's interesting that you're open about, you went into this for the money. You obviously became interested in actually helping another family, but it's true that to do something like that, you need to feel of use and of service to something. And it's not just, no amount of money is going to make you feel good about doing this if you don't get to know who you're doing it for.
No, not at all, I don't think.
So you made that first 30-ish K, and then what? So what did you do with the money? And then what did you do with your thought of surrogacy?
I actually was really frustrated at the end because I didn't realize how fast you could spend that much money when I thought about like the debt that we had. So we had some credit card debt. We had about $14,000 in credit card debt I paid off. I had to help my son buy a car. What I really wanted, my goal for the money was a down payment on a house. And we didn't get anywhere near close to that because we lived in Southern California and the market was crazy and it was getting crazier all the time. And my husband was at that point trying to scale his business. And so we had to make the decision, like, he's like, we could buy a house that we don't love and that we don't really want to live in a neighborhood that we don't want to live in, which is what I wanted to do. I was like, yes, that's what I want to do. And then we'll build equity.
That sounds great.
And then we'll go up from there. Yeah. And he was like, but then we like, if we're going to be working this hard and living in a place that we don't love, like I'm not going to feel motivated to work as hard as I'm working if I'm like, what am I doing this for? And he wanted to scale his company at the time. He wanted to bring on new employees and he was doing like mobile IT. Kind of like a geek squad type of thing. And so he needed to get a couple of vehicles and hire some employees and rent a space. And so we ended up using what was left of the money to invest in that. And I was resentful about it. But looking back, I'm like, I'm so glad that we made that decision. I think it was the right choice because his business was ultimately successful. It wasn't as successful as we had hoped it would be, but it got to a place where we were able to sell it and make a good significant amount of money. I think he sold it for like $250,000, which is not a ton of money either, which is so funny the way you start to think about money once you start having money is that more starts to feel like less.
Like,
but
it's not even that much. Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh my God, I spent $250,000 in my mind before it even hit the bank account, you know? But we used that to invest in our business now, starting our agency and everything. So it was able to snowball from there just by making good long-term decisions with it, mm-hmm. the money. But after that, I decided to leave teaching. And I was like, I was used to doing passion work. I didn't leave teaching because I wanted to work in surrogacy. I left because it became too much. The parents, honestly, were the hardest part of teaching. So I wanted to find something else to do. And I started looking into working in surrogacy world because I was interested in it. And I decided to do another journey at around that same time. So I started doing marketing for a fertility doctor. And then I got a job doing intake at a surrogacy agency. And then I started exploring, okay, I want to do this. I think I want to do this again. It had been about a year and a half. But now that I had gone through it, I had a lot more intention behind the choices I was making, like how much compensation did I want? If I do this again, what is it worth to me? Not $38,000, that's for damn sure.
For so, twins.
Yeah. And I'm not going to do twins again. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, not, you know, that's not a good plan to go in. It's a lot higher risk. There's a lot more complications, a lot more doctor's appointments. We had preterm labor, but ultimately very healthy babies born at 35 weeks and 3 days. But I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that again. But I want a higher compensation. And so I'm going to shop around agencies. I'm going to call every agency and say, what's your compensation? And then I'm going to say, well, what if I wanted this? Like, could you help me find a match that also I love and am excited about, but is able to compensate me what I wanted, which at that time it was 2018, and I wanted $75,000 for my base compensation for mm-hmm. a second journey.
How hard was it to find that and to name your price? And did you have to negotiate?
It was surprisingly not hard. And that made me so mad because I was like,
I could have done that in the first place.
Yeah, I could have asked for more in the first place. So I was able to find an agency that said, oh, we can find you that. I really wanted to help a gay couple again. My son had come out at that time and like, I really wanted to be supportive and show like, I love that community. But, when you set your compensation where you want it, you have narrowed down your pool of intended parents who can afford to pay what you're looking for. And there were still a ton of really amazing profiles, but what ultimately got me in the profile that I chose was the mom was also an English teacher, and she taught at a high school that was just for teen moms. So I felt just like so drawn to her. She's an incredible writer, and she wrote this really beautiful letter, and I was reading it when I got her profile. I had looked at a couple and I had passed on. And then I got that one. And I was on the plane with my sister. We were going to visit my grandma, and we like read it together, and we were both crying reading it because she had a really traumatic birth experience with her daughter, where she ended up losing her uterus and almost dying and spending time in a coma after delivery, and baby was in the NICU. And it was just like, she had really wanted to have a big family, and she had fought so hard to find the love of her life, and then couldn't get pregnant, had to do IVF, finally got pregnant, and then it was like taken away from her again. So the way that she told the story was really compelling. And it was like, oh, I have to help her. She also had two little dogs in all of her profile pictures. I'm such a freak about dogs. But so yeah, she ended up being the one.
Okay. And so that you made 75K with that. And what did you do with that money?
With that money, so we still put a lot of money into the business. We moved into a bigger house. We didn't buy a house, still didn't buy a house. I was so frustrated. I wanted to buy a house so badly. But we just invested in our life, and we were able to take vacations, like family vacations for the first time. And we went to Maui and took our daughter. And actually, what was really interesting is in the middle of that journey, we unexpectedly, my son had already moved out. So he moved out right when he turned 18, which was against my better guidance, but that's what he wanted to do. And he hasn't come home since. So he's 26 now. So I guess he made the right choice. But we found out his half-sister was taken into foster care. So my husband and I decided to get her out of foster care so that we wouldn't lose her, because, you know, kids, when they go into the system, I don't know if her parents were ever going to get their life together and get her back, or what was going to happen. Was my son never going to have access to his only sibling?
So she was the daughter of the person that was your son's father.
The biological father of my son.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you adopted her?
Yeah. Well, we took her in as a temporary foster at first. We didn't know where it was going to go, but I also was pregnant with somebody else's baby at the time. It was just like, it was a crazy time. We found out about Jasmine. So we're like, shoot, we don't have a couple extra bedrooms. And to bring in foster care, you have to have like a dedicated room for them. So we ended up having to find a bigger home to rent. And so we were able to do all of that because we had the savings. We were able to like put a big deposit down and do all those things without it being a hardship. And I also was able to take that job as an intake coordinator at an agency where I was making like $21 an hour. At 36 years old is not how much money you want to be making. But if you want to break into a new industry, you have to start somewhere, you know? So I think that compensation allowed me to explore different paths for my life than I would have been able to do if I didn't have that, the security of that savings.
Mm-hmm. And so then you did surrogacy one more time, right?
I did, yeah. And I had no intention of doing it another time after that.
Well, what happened?
So after that, I worked at that job for a little while. Then I got a job as a case manager at a surrogacy agency, which was a more, you know, in line with what I was earning as a teacher. And I did that for a while. My husband sold San Diego Computer Help when we took in Jasmine because he was working so much. He was never home. I was like, we can do this, but I'm not going to do it by myself. Like, you have to help me. So he sold that company, and then he started his own marketing company. And while he was doing that, he was like, this is growing and I need your help. He had gotten a decent amount of clients. And so we felt safe for me to quit my job with my insurance and my stable income and work for him and go all in on building his business. And that ended up being the really good, right decision to do. But it takes a lot. We spent so much money building the business. Like, everything that he made from San Diego Computer Help went into us just surviving to run his new business and grow that. And when we decided to start our Surrogacy Is, which is the company that we run together now, which is really fun and cool that we've been doing this for about 6 years, that we're able to work together.
So your husband works full-time on Surrogacy Is?
He does. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When we started, it was just he and I. We were in the garage. We were like, all of these agencies are trying to recruit surrogates and their marketing is so bad. And it's so like, I never would have responded to any of these ads that are like, pregnant women with like huge pregnant, like, you know, you have to get pregnant to be a surrogate, but that's not the selling point. You know, you're not like how hugely uncomfortably pregnant I could be. And then like dollar signs in the air. It's like, it just was gross. Yeah. And I never would have responded to an
like
ad
clip
like
art.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were all doing it the same way. And they were all struggling. Like every agency I worked for was like, we have so many intended parents. Mm. We can't find enough qualified surrogates. And so Kyle was in marketing his whole life. And he was like, we could do this so much better. Like we actually pitched the agency that I worked for as a case manager and was like, I know you guys are struggling to get surrogates. We could help you build this marketing funnel. And they almost did. They were like, no, we don't want to do anything different. We're going to stick with what we're doing. And so we're like, okay, fine. So we'll do it ourselves. So we set it up and built that ourselves. And it was just he and I for the beginning. And then my partner, Casey, joined us like a handful of months later. And I was like, I can't do all of this. Like I had to, all the women that would apply, I had to call them and do their application and educate them and do, like, I was on the phone for like 9 hours a day and I'm an introvert. So I was really drained. Yeah. I was like, I can't do this. I'm not going to call these people back. Like I love talking to them and I pour into those conversations. Right. But then at the end, I'm like,
you're done.
I want to just be alone and nobody talk to me.
First, your husband was skeptical about you doing surrogacy, and then you decided to do it. And every time you're doing it, you're putting your body at risk. You're going through a lot personally. And then you wanted to buy a house. Like you really wanted that money to go to down payment. But it sounds like a lot of the money went into back into his business or into other places. And in the end, you're like, it's fine. You know, looking back all these years. But in that moment, you know, what was that conversation like with your husband around? My body is literally bringing forth these tens of thousands of dollars. Don't I get to just decide where the money go? Like, how did that
yeah.
work?
We actually had, and we don't fight a lot. We're really good. We've been together for 20 years now. So we have a really good communication. Like we're really open and sharing and respectfully explaining how we're feeling. But I remember one time when I was pregnant with the twins, we were at dinner and we were talking about like, I had found a house that I was like, we could buy, we only need like $12,000 down payment. But it was a house that he didn't want to live in. He didn't want to live in a crappy neighborhood, you know? But that was what was our budget at the time. And so it was this tug of war, like, this is what I want to do. And he was like, well, this is what I think in the long term is going to get us what we want. And I thought, well, I think in the long term, this is going to get us what we want because property values go up all the time. So we'll start here. We'll live in this house for 3 years or whatever, and then we'll sell it and then we'll move, you know, grow from there. So my thinking has always been kind of smaller. Like I think small and safe. Like I know equity grows and then property values grow. At that time, it was pre-COVID. It was like 1-2% a year things grow. And he was thinking, well, if this business works, the growth is going to be exponential. So there's more of a path to get to where we want faster if we invest in the business and just keep renting for now. But ultimately, it was a mutual decision that like, okay, this is what we're going to do. And I was like, you better be right because I'm going to be really mad.
Yeah, because it's
not.
Still a big if. It's like, if this business is successful.
Mm-hmm. And how many businesses are not,
right.
You know? But it had had enough success at that point that I was like, okay, well, if it is going to be successful, we have to be all in together. And it worked out. But still, at the time that we started surrogacy, we still hadn't bought a house. We still hadn't bought a house.
So how did you finally end up being able to buy a house?
It took a lot longer than I thought it would. But like the way that we actually ended up buying a house is we could never do it in Southern California. We ended up moving to Georgia. So I was like, okay, we can build our business, but I need this damn house. Like I couldn't lose my mind. So we moved all the way to Savannah, Georgia, where the cost of living is like a third of what it is in Southern California.
And how did you pick Savannah?
We wanted somewhere that was still on a coast that had good weather, didn't snow, and it needed to be significantly less. So like we looked at Oregon and Washington and all these other areas that on the West Coast are still just, they're like, what, maybe 20% cheaper than Southern California. It needed to be a significant reduction in cost of living for it to be worth it for us to make that kind of a leap. So we came to visit Savannah. My husband didn't want to move and didn't ever want to leave California. But that was his compromise for me, was like, I've done all this compromising and I've done all of this to invest in our business and I still don't have my house. If I'm going to get my house, we have to leave California, or because I'm not waiting 5-10 more mm-hmm. years. I'm not doing it. We've been out here now for 4 years and I love it. It was the best decision. We made a lot of really good, risky, scary decisions that ended up being really good decisions.
So how much was your house?
Our first home that we bought was $450,000.
And that was in Savannah?
It was in Richmond Hill, just outside of Savannah. And then we lived in that house for about 2.5 years, and then we sold it, and then we bought this house, and this house was 1.2.
Mm-hmm.
But it's everything that we want, so it's worth it.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Let me back up a bit to why I did my third journey. I didn't want to, and it's so funny because my intended parents, they had 4 embryos and they wanted to have all those kids, the mom that I carried for in my second journey. And they had found another surrogate. Yes, it was the same family.
So same family that you carried for.
Yeah, okay. And we stayed in touch and I was done. I wasn't going to do it ever again. I was 39. I was like, I'm done. You know, I'm not, I don't ever want to be pregnant again. But she had found a surrogate and they were going through medical screening and the surrogate had said to the doctor, like, she was really afraid of the needles, the injections, IVF medications, it's a lot. And she was really afraid. And she had said to the doctor, like, I don't know if I can do this, but I'm going to try. I'll try, like, try my best. And my intended mom, like, panicked with that because, and we had gone through a lot together on our journey. Like, she had a really hard time trusting, and we had some back and forth of, like, it took us a while to get to a point where we're trusting one another because she had a lot of fear and wanted to control things, and I was resistant to that, and I wasn't understanding. We didn't have a lot of support, so we had some conflict, but we got through it. And so then when she called me and she was like, I'm so scared. Like, what if she says she's going to try? Like, what if she doesn't try? What if she's too scared and she doesn't take progesterone and she gets pregnant and she misses her progesterone injections because she's scared and then she miscarries? And like, I'm so scared. Like, how do I trust this other person? And I thought, we already worked so hard to build the trust that we had. And I didn't want to see her go through that again with somebody else. And I didn't want somebody else to go through that with her either. So I was like, I think I could do it one more time and help her have another baby. And I talked to my husband about it, and he was like, yes, you need to do that because we're going to grow our business. So, and then COVID hit, and he was like, yeah, let's do it. You can do it. It'll be fine. It'll be good.
But how were you feeling about it?
I was not excited to be pregnant again. It's so funny. This kind of makes Kyle sound bad. Like,
no, it's just funny. The first time he was like, this sounds like a bad idea. And then by the third time he was like,
I was just like, I know it'll be fine. But the first time too was really hard because my intended mom, she really wanted me to deliver at Cedar Sinai, which was in LA. I lived in San Diego. So I had to like relocate at the end of the pregnancy for the last month so that I could be near the hospital where I was going to deliver. And at that time, we had just taken in Jasmine and we didn't know that was going to happen. So that journey was really disruptive in my life because our new child that was very dependent on me had to be home to go to school. And Kyle would come every weekend and they would spend the weekend with me every weekend in LA until I delivered and went home.
How old was Jasmine at the time?
She was 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
and she really needed me and wanted, you know, so she had a hard time. But I think it was really good because when it was just me, she was very much wanted her mom. She didn't want Kyle's papa at the time so much. She wanted mom. And by me being taken out of the picture, kind of, and him being the primary caregiver for that month, their relationship really grew. And I think his understanding of what it took for me to like make all her lunches and get her ready in the morning and do all her laundry and pick her up from school and drop her off and do all those things that moms always end up by default doing. I think he had a renewed appreciation for that. And our relationship changed from that so much because now like he's more of the primary parent than I am. Which
and Jasmine
is amazing.
Still lives with you guys?
Yes. We ended up adopting her after about a year and a half of fostering. And so she just turned 12. And she's just the coolest kid. Such a gift. Such a gift. We're so lucky.
Wow. Okay. So I don't want to miss that. But so going back to you were reluctantly going into this third surrogacy, but then you decided, okay, this is the right thing.
I was okay to do it. But the thing that made me reluctant about it was that it was COVID at the time. And we didn't know a lot about COVID and the restrictions that my intended parents wanted to put on me during the pregnancy. Like they didn't want me to like eat out at restaurants or go, like they didn't want me to be exposed to other people to get sick. I lived at home. I worked from home. So it was easy for me to say that. But ultimately, I was like, what, you know, I didn't want to give up all that freedom necessarily, but I decided to do it anyway because we needed that additional money to pour into our business. And so it ended up being really good. It ended up being a really good pregnancy. And my intended mother was so much more relaxed that journey than she was in the first one. She didn't need me to move to LA and deliver at Cedars. She was happy to let me choose a doctor in San Diego and to deliver there because she had overcome a lot of that trauma that she had had from her own first birth. And she saw that we could have a healthy delivery and success. And the doctor was amazing. And it ended up being really good. I just have so much love and respect for that family. I love watching them, their lives unfold on Facebook and see these kids. Like they have 3 kids. And that wasn't going to be possible if it wasn't for surrogacy. Mm-hmm. It's really cool to know that like I did that.
Yeah, you did that. So that third pregnancy, you had more, or surrogacy, you have more awareness of the financials of it. How do you put a price on that one? Knowing what you know, knowing you didn't really want to do it, but you decided to do it. What goes into your mind of like, how do I put a price on something that is more than just the money? And yet at the same time, I do have to decide a dollar figure.
I think at that time, too, it was a little bit trickier because it was a sibling journey. And because I already had a connection with the family, I didn't ask for a lot more like I might have if it had been somebody new. So I just did it for $75,000 again. I just did the same as before. Actually, I think the second time it was $70,000. And then the third time I did $75,000. And I was okay with that. I knew we had no debt. We had a little bit of savings this was just going to be money to experiment with ad spend and pay ourselves our salaries for the year while we get surrogacy is off the ground.
So there's several countries around the world, including France, Germany, Italy, Sweden, and more, who have banned surrogacy, citing ethical concerns. Mm-hmm. What is your take on that?
I think in some of the countries, it's really religious based. And there are some countries where surrogacy is done that I think can be exploitative. Like there are surrogacy is legal in Mexico, in Ukraine, in Colombia. And I do think that there are women who are exploited in these countries, but they're willing to do it for less money. And so it's cheaper for intended parents to go there. Or the country of Georgia is now more popular since Ukraine is war torn. But I understand the reason of wanting to protect women from being exploited. The way that surrogacy is done in the United States, it's very much, I think, empowering for women and not exploitative. For me, I was really empowered by surrogacy. I was able to take something that only I can do as a woman and propel my life forward in a way. And I had the autonomy to choose the parents that I wanted to help. And screening for surrogates in the United States, the way it's done, is very intentional. You have to be financially stable. You can't be dependent on government assistance. You can't have a criminal background. You have to not have any ongoing psychological issues, like any personality disorders or major depression or anything like that. Like, it's very protective of women to make sure that they are safe and educated and qualified to go into surrogacy. I think surrogacy can be done ethically, and it should be done ethically. And if people knew the stories of the parents who want to have their children and build their families this way, they would not want to take that option away from them. I think that's diminishing women's autonomy. I feel like my life has been bettered because of it. I am where I am today because of surrogacy. I wouldn't be in this home with this podcast room if I didn't, mm-hmm. if I didn't do surrogacy, you know?
And yeah, there are families with two intended dads who really wouldn't have another way of having a biological child.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I think people hear a lot of the horror stories of things going wrong, and especially lately, there's been a lot of negative stories in the news, because there are, in anything, there's going to be people that exploit the system.
When you look at celebrities and you kind of assume that it's just like they didn't want to be pregnant, or, you know, they couldn't be bothered to go through that. And we don't know the real backstory, but that is kind of how it could
That's
seem.
What a lot of people think. And I actually have the unique perspective of knowing a lot of the backstory, mm-hmm. because we have helped a lot of celebrity or higher profile intended parents. And those people want just as badly to carry their own babies. Like, it's not something that people do. Although there are people who do choose surrogacy because they don't want to be pregnant for some reason or another. And maybe they're an athlete. Maybe they are they can't put their body on hold for that year, but they still want to build their family. But their livelihood depends on continuing to have the body that they want. And I think that's valid, too, as long as it's disclosed and the person who's deciding to help them chooses to want to help somebody for that reason. And a lot of times then you might have to pay a higher compensation because you're limiting the pool of surrogates. Because if there's a lot of surrogates who want to help somebody who's really struggling and can't carry and is, you know, had a lot of losses and somebody has that vision, then to settle for something different, they might want more compensation. So there's always that ebb and flow, that give and take in that matching process. But most of the people I know that are higher profile or celebrity intended parents really wanted to carry their own children and did everything that they could and couldn't. Like, infertility doesn't discriminate by class or race or anything. It doesn't care. They're fortunate to be in a position where they can afford surrogacy because it's expensive. But most people want to carry their own pregnancy. They really do.
How much is money and financial management talked about within the surrogacy community? I mean, both for the surrogates that they're going to get this cash infusion that, you know, they have to manage? Like, how is that discussed in the industry?
I don't think it's discussed enough. I know when I was working and when I first got into the surrogacy field doing intake, I worked with some young surrogates, and most surrogates are younger than I was. When I started, I was 33, right? Most surrogates are young, like
in their 20s,
young moms, young families that are like, this money is going to be life changing for them. But most people haven't had that kind of a windfall and don't have the financial literacy to make good decisions with it or think long term. How am I going to invest this? How am I going to put it away? I see people all the time buy like a new vehicle with their surrogacy money. And I think if that's something that you need or is helpful to you, that's your prerogative to spend your compensation that way. For me, I think investing that money that you work so hard for into a depreciating asset is not wise. Or I would see women that I worked with that were surrogates, they were like, oh, I have all this extra money. Like, I'm going to order lunch on DoorDash every day, and I'm spending $30 on lunch every day. Like, that's not wise financially. And so when we started surrogacy, as we were really focused on education, and we did a lot of webinars and things like that with talking about those things. And so one of the things I did was invite my financial planner to come and like talk about, like, if you're going to have this much money, what are some of the potential ways that you can invest it? What are some accounts you could put it in? What are some different things you could do? But that was years ago that we did that. And we haven't really done a lot since. And I don't hear people talking about it in this space about how to invest or how to take care of their money and make it go further. Because I have seen people do surrogacy, get a bunch of money, spend it, and then regret it. Be like, I bought new furniture and I bought a new car and now I don't have that money anymore. And I don't even
it's
like this furniture
grow.
And
yeah.
My car is worthless. So it's like, now I have to, I see people like, okay, I'm going to do another one. I'm going to do another journey. And then I'm going to make different choices with the money next time. It'd be nice if they had that foresight earlier. I do think there needs to be a lot more education about financial literacy for everyone in general, but definitely for surrogacy. And I'm glad you asked that. That's a good, I think I'm going to implement more of that into how we educate the surrogates that come through our agency now, because it's so important. And I think about it all the time. I always have, since I was little, have always thought about money and how to make it last and how to make the most of it. I didn't grow up with money. And my mom was always, I remember like dumping out our coin jars and like getting money together, like how we're going to pay rent this month. And I used to always save all my birthday money. And I always have been a saver and just very like, I'm like a squirrel with money. And my sister on the flip side, she loves to spend. So she would like, if she gets money, she spent it right away. I hoard it and put it away and then loan it to my sister. Now, when I was a kid, she'd be like, can I borrow? I know you have money in there. Can I borrow it? I think people need to think about that a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, it does bring up the question, like, whose role is it to have that conversation? Because surrogacy is unregulated. I mean, I think there's norms and there's procedures that most people follow, but there's no one saying, okay, they have to have a meeting with a financial planner and they have to enact the financial plan. I mean, and, you know, as the surrogacy agency, it's not really your job, but at the same time, if not you, then who is really going to have that conversation? So I think it's kind of interesting how this all comes together, and that you're the person that are the people that are the intended parents, they, through many different means, I'm sure, have this money. And mm-hmm. So it's this kind of interesting meeting of, you know, somebody who has, you know, $150,000 to spend on surrogacy with this other person who really needs that money, but may not have the guidance on what do you do when you get that kind of windfall.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot when I was a new surrogate. And when I was thinking about the disparity between where intended parents are socioeconomically versus where surrogates are. And I get why, that's why people think that surrogacy can be exploitative, and maybe it can be. But yeah, a lot of people that are young families or qualify for surrogacy, they don't know the first thing about money. They don't have financial literacy. Whose job is it? I think should be like schools, first of all, to talk about financial literacy. It should be your parents if they have the ability. But a lot of people's parents, my parents didn't have any the financial literacy either. So I had to seek it out on my own, and I had to learn as I went by myself, and really always just being afraid of not having enough and trying to think of ways to get ahead, like that even being what led me to do surrogacy in the first place. Is like, I want to have savings. I don't want to have debt. I want to buy a home. I want to do all these things. But a lot of people don't think like that. And I don't know, even if you do, I think you can't make somebody enact the financial plan just because you give them the information, right? Yeah. Like, you can't make them make good decisions. But I do think it's important to give them the information and then let them decide what they want to do with it. And so a lot of people like to learn things the hard way, and that, you know, that's their prerogative. But I do think there should be more education, whether it's even from the surrogate's attorney. So like when you are a surrogate and you're going over your legal contract, once you've matched and you've been medically cleared, you have a legal contract and it has this, you know, the Exhibit A that breaks down all of your compensation, the milestone payments, how it's going to be paid out over time. Maybe that would be a good opportunity for the attorney. I mean, attorneys are pretty financially literate, I would think, for them to talk about maybe just
where
planting that seed
going?
Even of
yeah.
like, yeah, or have you thought about how you're going to protect this money or invest this money and make decisions with it? Have you thought about that at all? Maybe it would just be a good time to even raise that question, because that's when you, when it's becoming real and you're really thinking about it is when you're signing that contract and you're looking at that. Like, I remember getting that and I had a spreadsheet and I was like, okay, this is where I'm going to, this is what I'm going to do first. I'm going to attack my high interest debt and I'm going to do that first. And then I'm going to do some savings. And I'm like, well, I don't want to put my money in a savings account that doesn't grow any interest. So then I had to like research, well, I'll get a high yield savings account. And this is before I ever even had a financial advisor and I got life insurance. Surrogates have to get life insurance. And a lot of young
pay for it themselves?
No, the intended parents pay for it. They purchase that policy. And it, the minimum back then when I was a surrogate was $250,000, which now I think is just like shamefully low. Our minimum through our agency is $750,000. I would prefer it to be $1 million, but it's actually hard to get a term life insurance policy for $1 million if you're 24 years old and you don't have any earnings. Like, some of those things are tied to earnings. So there's different policies that you can get. So it's easy to get a $750,000 policy. And it's the cost between that and a $250,000 policy is like a couple of bucks. It's not a lot of money. So I got life insurance for the first time and I got, you know, all these things. And I was like, okay, I'm learning. And I'm, I have a lot to learn still about financial literacy. So like, fast forward to now, we started that company ourselves, just the two of us. Our third partner came on. We did that together for about a year and a half. And then we had to grow and we hired our first employees and it was like really scary. And now we have a team of 36 and it's awesome. And it's we're helping so many people and we're making a really comfortable living. And I was able to buy my first home and then sell that and build my dream home that I have now. So I did get where I wanted to get from surrogacy. It just did not take the path that I thought it would be to get there.
Yeah. And it also wasn't a one-time deal. It was three surrogacies and a lot of discussion and planning and growth. Well, can I ask, how much money do you make now running a surrogacy agency?
I have a salary of $100,000. And then anything that our business profits, we keep in the business. So that's my salary is $100,000 and I'm comfortable with that. I could probably make more, but I don't. It's such a balance because you're like, I want to help people and I want to make a comfortable living. But I don't also, I'm not a person that feels good about like exploiting other people, which is why like I could make a lot more money if I didn't have a team of 36, if I didn't put in all the things that I do into supporting the journeys that we do, like all the mental health support that we build in and all the different, like there's so much that we put in that we don't make as much profit as we could off of our agency fee. And I know there are agencies that have a similar agency fee or higher than we do that don't provide as many resources and have a lot smaller teams. But I think what I learned from my surrogacy experience is to think about the long game, and I will make the money that I want to make. I know that I will by doing really excellent work and being the best agency. Like, that's my mission, is being the best and having the best. And then everybody will know and everybody will come to our agency and we will have sustained long-term financial success versus if I wanted to just do a bad job and get whoever was willing to pay and then treat them terrible throughout their journey, or like match them and set them off on their own and not support them. And then I could have keep so much more of that profit. But I want to be doing this for a long time, and I want to have 5 stars on every platform. And I want people to think of us as the gold standard for years to come. And so I don't think about how much am I profiting. I think about how long and how can we sustain this, and we'll make more money over time. But my husband also has a higher salary than I do because he's like our chief technical officer and chief marketing officer. So he makes good money too. So I think eventually we'll pay ourselves more, but everything right now that is extra profit, we just keep pouring in to the business because that's served us well.
And how does it feel? Because you wanted this for so long, you wanted a house. At times you felt resentful that's not where the money went. Many years went by. Now that you have it and you have this business that sounds like you're enjoying and you're making good money, how do you feel?
I have to remember to be like, to look back at where we came from, to be as grateful as I should be for what we have and where we are now. But I still always worry about, like, I'm not going to feel content until I have a really solid retirement savings. And I'm not going to, but I have to like pull myself back in and look around and be like, yes, okay, I have what I wanted. I am here. But it's also so stressful. Like, running a company of this size and the scale is very stressful. It takes everything. Like, it's my hobby. It's my social life. Like, fortunately, my best friend is my director of operations, and she just happens to be brilliant. And so I would never hire somebody just because they're my friend. But she's brilliant, and she's helped us scale in ways too. And my partner, Casey, is like total extrovert and loves talking to all the people, so I can be like behind the scenes so she can do all of that. But spending time with her and with my husband and with my best friend, like, that's where most of my joy comes from. But I think I need more balance. I don't have balance in my life that I would like to have, or that I even used to have. But I at least have a lot more financial freedom, like to take vacations and to do things. Like, this year we're going to take my daughter to Japan, and that's really cool. And that's not something that I could have done 5 years ago. And it's not something that I was able to do for Charlie, for my son, when he was young. We were young and struggling. And so I am really, really grateful, but I still never feel like, you never feel like you're all the way there, you know?
Oh, I mean, that's, I think, how most people feel. And when you achieve more, then you are aware of more because you're around other people who have more, and you're, you know, it never ends. And so that's the balance, is like, how do I just be okay with what I have, but, you know, still have goals, but not have those goals make me feel unhappy.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you started out by saying that after your son, you didn't want to have another kid. I mean, you were done, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And not only did you end up carrying other children, but now you're raising another kid who's not your biological kid. But
yeah,
it sounds like it's turned out to be such a blessing.
And oh, so, my gosh. It's the best. It's the best. Because
why
Kyle
is it
and
the,
I,
why is it the best?
Because when we got Jasmine, she was 4, and she was just perfect. Like, I just want to give her more because she's so happy and thankful and loving and appreciative of everything. And Kyle and I, when we got together, Charlie was six. And so he was always in that stepdad role where I was the mom and the primary parent. And he was also parenting, but it was different. Like with Jasmine, we were on equal footing. And so we're both raising this child together in a way that feels more like less pressure on me and more of a shared pressure, but also like sharing in just like, we're so excited to see her experience all these different things for the first time and know that like she's having the best life and we're giving her the best life. And we weren't able to do all these things for Charlie that we would have wanted to do because we were counting our money. Like I would have loved to have been able to take Charlie to Japan, but No, you know, we're able to do that with Jasmine. And Charlie loves seeing his sister thrive. He's not resentful or envy. Like I didn't have that when I was growing up. He's a good kid. So he's like happy to see her have everything that he didn't get to have. And it's just been really fun raising her. And that wasn't the plan.
Mm-hmm. What do you indulge in?
My biggest indulgence now is slow mornings.
I'm the same. I'm obsessed with that, but I always feel so indulgent whenever I have one.
I feel so guilty, but
it's
I also
amazing.
Feel like,
yeah.
Oh, it's so good. It's like every day, especially from leaving the West Coast and coming to the East Coast. Now, a lot of the people that I work with, like especially Casey, my partner and our director of operations, they're in California. So they don't start until 7 a.m. Pacific, which is 10 a.m. my time. So I get up at 8 and I take a bath, I take a long bath every morning, which people make so much fun of me for doing. I love taking baths, live in the bathtub. And then I have my coffee and then I get dressed and I put my makeup on or whatever. If I want to, I don't have to because I work from home and I don't do a lot of outward facing meetings. So that's my indulgence, is like just taking that slow time. And then I end up working later. You know, I work like 10 to 6, but I can just set my day the way that I want to.
I was actually just thinking about that this morning because the weekends for me, my daughter is 6 and my husband and I switch off weekend morning. So Saturday morning is completely free for me. I do whatever I want, and I'm grateful for that. But I think I feel like a pressure, like, okay, this is your time. You better do
something.
You have
to make the most of it.
Yeah. And then the rest of the weekend is like, you know, running and gunning. I mean, she's, you know, we're doing things that include her and, you know, her mood can really dictate how the weekend goes. And it's actually not that relaxing. It's not really what a weekend is. And it's fine. And it's great. We always have fun. But the days when it's just a Monday or a Tuesday and she's off at school and it's 8 a.m. and I have an hour to just tidy up the house and putter around is actually kind of my favorite time. And I think it's because I feel a sense of control. Whereas other times I don't, because it's just like, oh, this person and that person. And this is like the only time that it's just me and I can really do whatever I want right now. And it also doesn't have to be a big production. Yeah.
That's my favorite thing about my life right now is that those slow mornings.
What does enough look like to you?
I definitely have enough. I have more than enough. I think as far as financially, I have enough. What I want more of is now I just want to have an impact in other people's lives. Like I want more women to know about surrogacy as a way to level up their life. Like I think people are afraid of it or think it's weird. So I really want more women to know like how life-changing it can be. And I want people to see what we're doing and like admire the impact that we're having. I think just like what I want now, I think it's like some recognition and respect for what I've created. Like that's the most important thing to me now. I think it's just that people recognize that this isn't an easy thing. This hard of work to get everything that you want is not easy, but it's worth it.
Sunshine, thank you so much for being on Other People's Pockets. It was really fun to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. I love having these kinds of candid conversations. I feel like people don't ask these questions enough and they don't share. And I think it's really important. I think it's really eye-opening. I wish I could have found your podcast when I was younger and listened. Like, how do people get all the things that I want?
Well, thank you again. It was really fun to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Other People's Pockets is written, hosted, and executive produced by me, Maya Lau. Kristen Torres edited this episode and provided booking and research. Thank you to Pushkin Industries for past production support. Please follow or subscribe to Other People's Pockets on your platform of choice. Check out the video version on YouTube and email me with guest ideas, questions, or other suggestions at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com. See you next time.